finally, a psychotherapist that focuses on helping people strive for self-awareness and thrive for self-satisfaction with their place in the world. It's a show for real people with real lives, with all the drama, trauma, and chaos that life can throw at you. Here she is, Dr. Bev.
Welcome to Emotions Are Us, your host, Dr. Bev. I'm here with my guest, Dr. Larry Richardson. Dr. Richardson, today I would love to discuss with you, because you are such the historian from Storyville to Presentville to Futureville when it comes to mental health. And my greatest concern is, what ways can we be better mental health allies and advocates? What could we tell the public? Where we came from, where we're going, what could we do to be better mental health advocates? Whether you're a mental health, a professional, a parent, a friend.
Well, I think one of the things is, I remember from graduate school that in one of my first classes, it talks about being the best person you can be, and that you had to either resolve your own issues that you were bringing in, or be in some state of resolution of your own issues before you would have the right to confront a patient with their issues, because in some way that'll make you not an authentic person. And the only way you could deal with other people's problems is deal with your own problems effectively.
Oh, I so much agree with you. As a supervisor for interns coming into the field, that's one of the things that I really, really encourage them to do, because usually in grad school, they haven't had a chance to do that. And so I really encourage them during supervision that they be in therapy, that they resolve any untapped issues, or at least begin to know that they have some unresolved issues before they go out into the field. Know what it feels like to walk into an office, what to expect, what, so that you can better handle your clients. And to further that, I just, being the psychotherapist that I am, I encourage everybody to get some MH. Mental health, just some emotional health counseling, if for nothing else, just to be a better person. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I think that's very important. People's concept of mental health is not, it's framed by social media, the news, and a lot of inaccurate information. Mental health has to do with a person's ability to grow and develop appropriately into a fully functioning human being. So therefore, I think part of it is that sometimes people need a little extra help, and you do not have to be mentally ill or psychotic or clinically depressed to get help. I think the part of mental health that's been left out is that kind of mental health tune-up, that checkup that many people need initially and throughout their life, because more than likely something is not going well or going in the wrong direction, and that those can be easily corrected and altered very early in a person's life.
That is so very true. If we started, and maybe that would be one of the initial things that we, you know, we do as just in the community, to know that your child can be suffering from depression or bullying or something like that. And if you are not accustomed to getting counseling yourself, you wouldn't even think about that for your child. But there again, that brings me to the acceptance and support of someone going to counseling. In different communities, it's accepted different ways. And in some communities, it's not accepted at all. In other communities, it's just looked upon as affluenza, you know, the only way my son became mentally deranged, or, you know, raped a girl for, you know, 20 minutes. He's not responsible for that, is because he has affluenza, which, by the way, is not in the DSM-4. So just the community getting some acceptance, taking the shame and the blame away from it, I believe that would bring more people into our doors at an earlier age.
Yes, I think we need more education, especially in the African American community, Hispanic, Latino, and other underserved areas. I think there's a lot of misconceptions and myths about mental health and mental illness that need to be dispelled. I think traditionally and culturally, African American communities have been pretty closed, and at some point they could take care of a lot of things within their families and communities. This has, of course, changed a lot, and there's a greater need for mental health services, even if you just educate people so that they'll know when to get help. And it's not just mental health, it's health care totally. We represent probably less than 26% of the population, but probably more than 75% or more of the chronic diseases that lead to death and disability. Even though we have one of the largest healthcare organizations in the world, we're still some of the sickest people in the world. Our infant mortality rate, for instance, is in some places more than third world countries, and that's unacceptable. I think the whole issue of access to healthcare is one, and acceptance of healthcare, which would include mental health, physical health, medical, spiritual, is something that we've got to really get a grip on and come up with a comprehensive plan so that the community will understand that these are great resources that can improve the quality of their life and their community.
Dr. Richardson, I have to ask you, especially since I went to the affluenza case that's in the news now about this young man. And so we're going from one extreme to the other extreme. If you could imagine that you could create such a world where community mental health, just mental health, emotional health, like you said, health care, that's mental, spiritual, physically, all of that. If you could create such a system, what would it look like in your world?
Well, it has to start with the real center of everything, which would be the family, and then the community. And I would envision that every person of any influence would have to be on board. Clergy would have to be on board, community leaders, organizations within the community, that everyone would have to be on board and come to a consensus on what's healthy for this community, and then implement a comprehensive plan from the cradle to the grave plan on how to improve the health indicators for this community. Mm-hmm. I think no one ever implemented it that comprehensively. People talk about it. They had this big thing about a contract with America, and all that's really nice with intellectual debating. But where the rubber meets the road is that parent who has a child that's autistic, or a child that has ADHD, or is clinically depressed. Then what do you do after the person's very ill and you need to do some intensive work just to get the person back? But my plan would envision everybody who has any influence or energy or time to invest in the health of the community. And it means, like when I was in the Navy, when they said all hands on deck, I mean, everybody who wasn't doing something essential to the operation of the ship had to stop what they're doing get out on deck and take care of whatever was going on, because that became a priority.
I can really understand that. It would just be one of my best wishes come true that one of our presidential candidates would take up such of an initiative and listen to your words. I think that would might even change the course of this particular presidential race. If one of them, Donald, Hillary, Bernie, whoever, took up that cause and said, I'm going to do something that no one else has done. And no one else has said what you said in that presidential race. No one else has brought up the subject of mental health, except when, you know, they're calling, you know, someone names and that sort of thing, or talk about some killing and guns if, you know, the person didn't. It's not the guns that kill people. It's the people who are mentally ill with the guns that kill people. It's just so off-kilter and doesn't make much sense to me. What you're presenting to the community as is, like you said, let's stop where the rubber meets the road here. All hands on deck.
Yeah, I think the point is, and I'm going to show a lot of restraint in giving my opinion about politics. I'm going to show a lot of restraint, and I'm going to not get emotional about that. I think we have to put things in perspective.
Okay.
When I graduated with my master's degree originally at the University of North Florida, I was probably the most intelligent and smartest person I knew at that time. My IQ was the highest probably in the world. And as soon as I got my diploma, it went down probably about 25 points. And I haven't been able to recover that. So I think some things, politics has to put things in perspective. And we sometimes get caught up in the emotionalism of things and lose our rational sense. We have been given both an emotional part of our being and a rational, and it's appropriate to use them under the right conditions. If we appeal to emotionalism and people saying things without the rational reasoning part, then we're going in the wrong direction. At some point, we may need to stop and say, what does this really mean? What does it mean for me? What can they do for me? You have to ask the question. One of my prototypes, mentors was Dr. Asa Hilliard III, is the eminent psychologist. Mm-hmm. And he used to say, if you want an answer, you ask a question. If you want the right answer, you ask the right question. We're not asking the right questions of some of these politicians. Like the song, I think it was Janet Jackson, I'm quoting probably another historian, Janet Jackson, says, what have you done for me lately? So I think we have to look up people's records, challenge them on these emotional issues, and challenge them on, can you really do this? Are you just saying this to get elected? Can you really decrease unemployment? What's your plan? What's your plan for unwed mothers? What's your plan for the food stamp program? What's your plan for to increase educational opportunities for those who have the least opportunities? Tell me what's your concrete plan to solve this problem, and do you have the power and ability to do it? And I think that's the part of politicians. Often they do sound bites. They attack one another. They say all these things, and it's usually meaningless and insignificant. And we really don't challenge them to come up with concrete, positive plans that's going to result in a positive outcome. And I'm very grieved about that issue, because we don't challenge them. I think we don't challenge them enough. Cut off the rhetoric, cut off the attack. And what are you going to do for those people who are at the greatest risk? Our seniors, our young people, our young mothers. What are we going to do for them, and what are going to be the issues that affect the quality of their life? I mean, that's what I would ask. They never asked me. No one ever asked me that. If I will, I'll tell them, like my grandmother say, I'll give them a piece of my mind, but I won't give them too much because I need most of it for myself.
Well, you just gave America Out Loud a piece of your mind, because everybody has heard this and will hear this. And perhaps, you know what? You may be getting a call from one of these presidential electors, okay? So that you can advise them on how they can do that. Because you would be the person to advise them. You've been in this field how long, Dr. Richardson?
Oh, Lord, you had to ask that.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yes, I do.
I was originally licensed in 1987. That's my originally licensed. So technically, I've been in the field since then. I was actually before then, but that's the part of my professional career. Began as a licensed mental health counselor.
And what I've known about you and read in your bio, that you have continued so many forms, whether it be as a professor, as a seminar, as a lecturer, the many things that you've done in the community, is that you have purposely put yourself out there to stop the stigma around mental health, because it's rooted in fear. And as a therapist, you say that this stereotype with people with mental illness are a threat and a danger to the public. That's what most of these, and that's what you're saying when it comes to the political part of it. They're looking at mental health as those dangerous people, as those people with, you know, schizophrenia, which really isn't dangerous, especially if properly treated and medicated. It's not. But they put this negative connotation in our minds to make us think that this is so scary. If someone knows about this, you know, what would they say? But you're right. We haven't asked the politicians, and we're not going to get too far into politics, okay? But just deep enough, say, like your Nana said, okay, we're going to give them a piece of our mind, but we're going to keep some of our mind for ourselves, okay?
Yeah.
And that is that no one is asking the right questions. So I want to hear you say that again. If you were speaking to any one of these politicians, if they let you on the panel to ask questions, what would be exact questions you would ask? 1, 2, 3, 4.
Well, one of the questions I would ask would be, what type of plan do you envision in which every American would be assured of at least three things? One would be the best possible health care and access to it without barriers. Everyone. The other one would be the issue of education and access to education, so that everybody who desired to would have access to whatever educational process that is in line with their potential and ambition. And the third one would be that, how would you ensure that every American family or individual be entitled to safe and affordable housing? And I think those would be the three things, at least I would ask them what their specific plan that would ensure that. Because I don't think anyone has, I haven't heard at least anyone say what they're going to do. I think one of the things that they're faced with mental health is when someone is shot, 10 people, or a mother has killed her children.
Yes.
And everyone's appalled. I always look deeper into that and say to myself, with a broken heart, by the way,
yes.
What factors would influence a mother to go against her maternal instincts and murder her kids? And then I would think, what about those other thousands or millions of mothers who are at risk to do the same thing? And then what would or could we do to minimize or eliminate that happening in the future? That would be my question. I was taught research, which I didn't like in my doctorate program, but the research taught me how to dig very deep and answer my own questions and not depend on other people to answer them for me. That it was my responsibility to research, dig deep, and maybe not even traditional research, but just common research into all these questions coming up that have no answers. It's up to me to find the answers to those questions. And also, at the same time, educate others in certain basic things so that they'll have a similar approach. Is that there's a lot of things happening, and there's a lot of questions, and there are a few answers. Then hold myself accountable to find the answers, and then share that with other people. And I think that would be helpful. I probably wouldn't appear but one time, and I would be wrote off as a radical. From the 60s, we were called Negro agitators because we had a different opinion about the quality of life. And it wasn't always articulated in some real nice, sweet manner. It was a lot more direct. And people have trouble with direct because direct tends to be very truthful. It just upsets people because it's so blatant and point blank without all the little rhetoric in it. I think we really do need the challenge. And I've spent my entire career helping people, even though some of my colleagues won't do it. I still do volunteer work in the community. I worked in Section 8 housing, the after school program. I've worked in HIV/AIDS substance abuse services. I worked with a colleague of mine. I worked at Westside Community Center, which allegedly is in a underserved, so-called poor neighborhood. And I'm currently working also at another community center, which is actually a fairly affluent area, but that area has Section 8 housing and many underserved kids. So that's what I'm still doing. That's my paying back or paying it forward, whatever they call it, and my contribution while I'm still here. Well, that's the wrong answer.
And it, you know, but that was the right answer. That was all of the things that we really needed to hear in terms of how can you be a better ally? How can you be a better mental health ally, an advocate? You have put it out there. And you know what? If you were on the panel, I believe that they would have you back the second and the third time just because they won't believe that you would be that direct and want those direct answers for everyone here in America. And on America Out Loud, you can say it. As a matter of fact, you've just said it.
We
would support you on the way that you would be back on the panel because you would be the ones asking the direct questions. And make them squirm, but make them offer some kind of accountability, right. Some kind of advocacy for our communities, especially in the realm of mental and emotional health. We're going to be right back with Dr. Larry Richardson. This is your host, Dr. Bev, here on Emotions Are Us at America Out Loud.
Are you a homeowner facing foreclosure? And you don't want to lose your home? Or perhaps you're ready to invest in the real estate market, but you don't have the time or the knowledge to find the right deals. Whatever your real estate needs, Victory Fields has the solution. Call us today at 877-563-6175. Again, that's 877-563-6175. Victory Fields. A real estate development company.
Dr. Richardson, you have put forth many things in our first part of our talk that were very direct. They weren't things, they were answers. They were questions that you would put out not only in politics, but just in your community in general, and especially for mental health providers. And as you were saying, that unlike many of our colleagues, because I'm there with you, we do go out into the community and do pro bono work. We work with those who are really in need. And you brought something up to me that I've recently been working on, and that is, in an affluent part of the community in which I live, they have built Section 8 housing and what's the other kind of housing with the, they actually build a house. Jimmy Carter started it.
Oh, that's the Habitat.
Yeah, for Habitat. So they've been building those houses in very affluent areas. And so it's become a major issue with some difficulty between the two communities. One community feeling like they are, they have the right to do, the right to have affluenza, you know, but the person in the housing community, if they came up with that for defense, tell me why it wouldn't work.
Well, it's very interesting. I remember a couple of years ago, when young white kids in the suburbs, in response to their contact with hip hop, were doing a lot of negative things. And I remember hearing a news commentator say that all of the negative values from hip hop had permeated the suburban community. So they were blaming hip hop for it. Mm-hmm. Not the fact that these youngsters actually chose to exhibit this. It's always ironical, and I'm amazed at how all these contradictions we have in America. Now, I'm going to talk a minute, and some people are going to turn the radio off, but that's okay.
Now, we're on America Out Loud. You know, they actually want to hear this directness.
Okay,
they want to hear the authenticity. They want to hear the real for real. That's why we are Emotions Are Us. So you go ahead and say whatever you want to say.
Bring it out. America of contradictions. They talk a lot about racism, but of course it's much deeper than that. And people say one thing and do another. They talk about equal opportunity for all and the Constitution. All men are created equally and endowed by the Creator with such certain unalienable rights, among these of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's what their founding fathers said in the Declaration of Independence. But none of that's true. America's always been divided. I don't know why people are so surprised by the division. It's always been divided on racial, cultural, and economic lines from the beginning. This country was founded on a lie and hypocrisy. When it was founded by their founding fathers, the only people who had power were white men of primary English, Dutch, maybe German descent. They were the influential people. Slavery existed. Women had no rights. Children had no rights. The only people who could vote were white male landowners. Even some white groups were marginalized because they were not the Western European group. This type of attitude has permeated the entire American society. And this so-called dream is really a myth in which equal opportunity, you can do this, people have to fight, women have to fight, African Americans have to fight, Hispanic Latinos are fighting for stuff that we should have based on the Constitution. So what happens when people are say equal opportunity until they come to their neighborhood, and then they'll say, no, not in my neighborhood. You know, that's a total contradiction. When we know that probably less than 20% of the population controls probably more than 90% of the wealth of this country, and that's old money and new money people. Nothing has really changed since 1776, not what you would think when they had the first Declaration of Independence, and I've been in the Pentecostal in Philadelphia. But we're living a lie and a contradiction. So I believe in dealing with reality. In the country, they say reality is what you step in when you don't watch where you step in when you cross the barnyard.
Mm-hmm.
So if we at least come to grips with what our situation is, then you can develop a better plan to deal with it. Because the people we're dealing with really have no respect for us as individuals or our culture at all. So you got to, one thing I learned in the military is you really got to know the terrain. You got to know your enemy. You got to know all the variables you need to know so that you can get the best possible strategy for victory. And you have to define what victory is. I am not surprised or alarmed or appalled too much anymore. It's like losing your ability to blush, because sometimes I feel blush occasionally. That's your upbringing, I guess. I think we're going to have to deal with the reality of this situation and probably change some of our tactics. The reality is these affluent communities don't want anyone in it who don't look like them, period. I don't care what race or culture they are. They don't want Section 8 housing. They want America on their terms, which means you keep your affluent communities, keep all these other people out, and have live your life in your little enclave, you know, gated communities with all your little suburban things. And I'm not cracking on people who have that.
Mm-hmm.
More power to them. But what happened to the inclusiveness and the equal opportunity stuff that people preach? They preach it one day, and it's in condemnation the next day. It depends on how it suits them.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing reality is what helps you to define reality for you, and then that helps you to be healthier as an individual. We're often blindsided because we get caught up in this romanticized stuff, the way they put it out, the news media, and people end up being very disappointed and hurt when it doesn't come out the way it should. And I think we have to deal with reality, even though we may not like it.
We may not like it, but you know what? Real is real is real. And real recognize real. We as Americans recognize that in terms of America going forward in a positive direction, we're going to have to recognize some of these lies, these non-truths, and bring them to the real truth. If that were only possible. But as you just said, it's been impossible since our founding fathers, and we're still skirting around the subject. We are still talking about how can we be an advocate for mental health? What can we do? We can educate, we can do this, but we're talking about it. And I know we talk about it here on Emotions Are Us, but where is that support coming in from those that really can make a difference just by giving some real sound bites, you know, like not calling people crazy, because that has such a negative connotation and it's derived from denouncing those who are struggling with mental illness. Just to call them crazy, that doesn't help. It doesn't help the situation at all. And it hasn't helped the situation since time immemorial. What do we do differently now? No, you didn't get cut off on Emotions Are Us. America Out Loud is not going to cut you off. Why? Because you're speaking the truth. And the truth is the truth.
You know, I just did a 34th annual Mental Health in the Black Community Conference in Jacksonville. and I've been involved with it for 33 years, and I think I've presented every year since then. That's very disconcerting. I just dealt with that reality. But the topic I did was applications of African-centered, clinical applications of the culturally-centered, African-centered behavioral change model. And what I talked about was how to reconceptualize and revisualize who people are and what the social value spiritual system that motivates them. And I think I shook people up a little bit and kind of shook myself up, I guess, because what I envision for them is this. Look at yourself as not just being a U.S. citizen or a resident of Florida, because we were divinely created as universal beings. There was no state of Florida, the United States of America, or Germany, or England existing. God created us. We were created as divinely created human beings in the context of the universe. And we're all interconnected by that fact. And later, of course, during the history of mankind, languages, cultures were developed. No races developed. That was a Western European concept of classifying people according to, which is kind of crazy, according to color, head shape, and all kind of different things that anthropologists did. It didn't work because it wasn't consistent with the created beings. But that's what has divided us a lot. What if youngsters, an African-American youngster living in an inner city, looked at himself as interconnected to everyone else, as a universal being, divinely created, and introduced them to a concept of social values that would shape and mold who they are to become? Seven Verses of Mayotte is one example of that. Or your concept of spirituality separate from religion. What is your first allegiance? To the God who created you, irrespectively of religions and denominations. I think I shook a few people up who, when I said that.
Oh, well, let them be shaken up. Keep shaking us up some more.
Yeah, and I use the concept in my practice. I present on it all over the country with some acceptance by some other folks and skepticism by others. But I always tell people I'm responsible for what I say, but I'm not responsible for what you hear. I'm going to present what I feel is an authentic message based on sound principles and research. But I think part of this issue is how people see themselves. Part of mental health is helping people identify unhealthy feelings, perceptions, and behaviors, and then changing them so that they become healthier so that the person can continue their development. That's a big issue. How are we to turn this around so that people have a different concept of who they are? Because maybe that will strongly influence on who they can become. The whole developmental issue is on this concept of being, belonging, and becoming. That's an African-centered principle that has to do with development.
Yeah.
Who do you belong to? That's a sense of cultural identity. Who are you to become? That's your future. So it's being, belonging, becoming. You belong to someone. Many people don't feel they belong. A lot of our youngsters don't. That's why they're always trying to get in gangs and doing certain things that they call aberrant behavior, because they're searching for somewhere where they can belong. If your culture doesn't provide a meaningful and significant definition of that, then they create some other culture that will do that. So that being, belonging, and becoming becomes the future. Who are you to become? A lot of people now that I see have no sense of that. They're doing, I see a lot of women, African-American women, for disability determinations. These jobs are killing them psychologically, emotionally, and physically. They're burning them out. When you see 25, 30-year-old with stress-related illnesses, high blood pressure, it's amazing. It's heart-rendering. And part of what I do is not to return them to work, but restore them to health and give them healthier definitions that define who they are, and giving them some hope that they have the ability to change some of these conditions and circumstances, helping them develop a plan for the future so they could be strong African-American women with skills to cope and deal with all of these issues they're dealing with. And that's a totally different approach to mental health. It's empowerment. It's redefining, restructuring, realigning, putting things back in the proper order, defining who they really are as universal beings, giving them a social value and spiritual system that can help them move to the next level in their life. And that's what I do in my practice.
Well, when you say universal beings, I can see that thought concept going all across from every culture, every being, period, from every extreme, from poor to the very affluent. If we could just all just simply see ourselves as just not just a person, but as someone who's interconnected to the whole. Because if I was interconnected to the whole, to the whole being, and really understand that concept, then many of the things that are happening in America right now would not be happening. We would not have, you know, we talk about black gangs. Well, you know, last week I had someone on a radio show, the white kids don't call it gangs, but, you know, they get together and they do the same inappropriate behaviors that are being done in other communities. They just call it by a different name. They're still smoking pot and getting high and having pill parties where they're taking all of their parents, prescription drugs out of the medicine cabinet and putting it in a bowl, and somebody bringing this and that. And they have these pill parties. So they're still wanting to belong, to connect with someone who is like them, who's doing the same inappropriate things as they are. But on the front, they're straight A students and doing what their parents have asked them to do, to portray a certain kind of image. But that image is being really distorted because, as you said, they don't see themselves interconnected with anybody else. They see themselves as truly being one. Maybe not one person alone, but many people see themselves as alone and apart from this society, the communities where they live. They feel separate and apart. And as you say, sadly enough, it is so inappropriate. And if we could start from that, and I'm not going to kick you off the show. No. I'm agreeing with you. Universal being. I just want you to repeat that again. So America Out Loud, Emotions Are Us. Don't say that you don't know, because now you do know. So act like you know. Give that concept one more time, Dr. Richardson, about being a universal you being in this America, in this society.
Well, the concept is from the principles of Maillard, from what the Europeans call Egypt. But, of course, it was a very high civilization, which was actually the progenitor to everything else, some of which, of course, was stolen. But the concept is that we were all divinely created by God. A very unique creation. We were given the power of the spirit as an energy source to change things, to change us, to give us energy to become who we need to become. So if someone can visualize, and it's difficult because the concept of the spirit is very elusive for some people, and they think that it's directly attached to the practice of religion or denomination, and it's not.
It
is attached, but it's separate from, because we were created as universal beings with the power to access the spirit before religions or countries or anything existed. But what it does, it tells you that that was created irrespective of race or culture or anything else. It made you a citizen of the universe, divinely created by God, so that everybody else that were created is part of who you are. It gives you that interconnect, so you never would feel that you're by yourself, that you're connected to every other human being. Now, what happened also is that everyone may not have the motivation to access all that spirit and influence the life. Even those who are connected to particular churches or denominations. But it's clearly documented in all the major religions about the existence of a divine God who divinely created human beings with the intent on them having the power to be who they need to be, that being, belonging, and becoming. We've marginalized that, of course, and we became so individualistic that it's all about us as an individual, and people don't want to access the true power. They want to access these little minor powers, those dealing with drugs and fame and power and acceptance. Mm-hmm. That's what leads to the mental illness, a lot of unhealthy definitions of who people are. So that's why a young African-American male can murder and kill another one with no remorse, because they have lost their concept on the preciousness of life. They have killed someone who actually is a part of who they are. You know?
That. Now, yes, I know, and I holler for you when you say that. My grandson was killed recently. He was coming home from college and had in January. And somebody in that community riddled his body with an AK-47. And I thought to myself, just as a human being, what could be going on in your mind and yourself that you could kill an innocent young man trying to do something and change this community? How could you be so separate and apart from others that you could do this to another human being? That's that being, becoming, and belonging. They don't feel as if they belong to this universal connectiveness. They feel separate and apart, and just, I can't even go on with the words because it just blows me away.
Yeah, what happens is that sometimes what they call the alienated self, in which people, their self or concept of who they are becomes an alienated aspect of their being, so that these social values and behaviors that we expect for people to exhibit become non-existent because the person has no social value system that's healthy. So what we look at as appalling and that unacceptable becomes quite acceptable because the person has created their own values and norms that actually are anti-African, anti-humanistic, human beingness. So their behavior becomes appropriate for who they are or who have they have become, which means they're an alienated person. They don't have that concept of spiritness, which gives them the power to understand who they are. A couple of good books for that, Dr. Naeem Akbar has done a lot of really good work on the African self, excellent book that I used working with youngsters was his book he wrote about visions for black men. And he wrote in that book, he's done a new edition. He's got so many books. He got Know Thyself. There's another book. He's got a lot of books. Someone needs to Google him and buy some of those. Those books help shape and mold who I was to become early in my mental health career. But Visions for Black Men, I used that as in a group I did for African-American males, primarily in a program called Parents Fair Share. And we met with men, myself and another colleague, to get them to understand their relationship with their children and their baby mama, so to speak. And what we used in that was this concept, developmental concept, of boyhood, boyhood, manhood, and warriorhood. And with great difficulty, we introduced them to the universal concept and how they should find themselves. They were boys do boyhood things based on being boys, very immature, impulsive, not thinking things through, and really playing games. At some point, regardless of your chronological age, some boys never grow up to become men. Manhood, of course, meant that they had more responsibilities, did more positive things, but they still were not where they needed to be. Being a man is a biological definition, but it's also a psychological and spiritual definition of being a man. So you'll see men who are men chronologically, but still playing boys' games. Father and children out of wedlock and not taking care of them. Being part of gangs. Failing and refusing to take advantage of educational opportunities to improve themselves and move up further. They have issues with education, so they are unemployed, and then when they become unemployed, some of them feel it's justifiable to sell drugs and take from other people. Those are boys playing boys' games, just like playing marbles and pick-up basketball. The ultimate developmental piece in this was becoming a warrior. Warriors love themselves, love the community, and they treat African women like queens. They respect them, they love them, they defend them, and they're willing to die for the good of their community. But then they're doing the positive things, making adjustments when they're wrong, admitting they're wrong, changing, raising other boys up to become men, real men, and then warriors. And I think we have lost that, where we had real men who became warriors, who brought other boys up in this value system of being real men and warriors. And I think we have men, boys being raised up without that, a lot of them being raised without that. We don't have a sense of close community anymore. Communities were broken up by this myth of integration, and it was a myth, still is a myth. There's no true integration of people who are different, because we need to maintain our cultural integrity, be a part of the overall culture, but maintain our community cultural integrity, because culture is the way we define who we are, where we came from, who we are, and where we're going. And I think we got to start back from the basics, and it's got to be comprehensive that real men and warriors have to step up. Women step up as warriors also, conceptually. There were many very strong, still are, very, very strong African women who stand up for these principles. And we need that cadre of warriors who are willing to make the changes. And you have to start one day at a time, one child at a time, one community at a time. It's a lot of work, but it's not impossible, but we got to start somewhere. I didn't mean to go on that long.
I wanted to hear everything that you said and to let my audience hear that again, because I think it's just so important that we all understand that we are connected to every other being. We are connected to everyone, and that you have many programs that you've started, many researches that you've done and put into practice, and, you know, made a program out of that. I want my audience to know that Dr. Richardson is available, and please do. We'll have all his contact information on his bio page. So don't worry about that. And I might even put a picture of him up there, although he says he might be recognized by the U.S. government.
So if there's any in the post office that has any striking resemblance, it's purely coincidental.
Say it's purely coincidental. Yeah. I love that. But I love the fact that as a clinician, you have come up with many ways for us to be allies and advocates for each other. No matter what your community, no matter what your color, no matter what your being is, you are still interconnected to this universe, and you were divinely created by a God self, not a God of self-hate, but a God self. And that is universal, no matter what you call, you know, your God, a Mazda, Job, whatever it is. It's still one and the same in terms of not religion, but spirituality, that we are all connected. We all are being, belonging, becoming. That is what, if there's one thing we could put out there, is that, you know, everyone has a part in that. Everyone, whether you're a clinician, a pastor, someone who is in high esteem, that has some power, connections, we can all work together to make this happen in all communities, because in all communities, they are being, they're being let down. They're not being taught. They're not being accepted as interconnected human beings, but separate and apart, elite and or entitled.
Yes, I wanted to quickly give you a couple of definitions, one of culture, one of cultural values, and probably also the seven virtues of Mayotte, because these are some of the core values that are going to be important. One for culture is the human process representing the vast structure of behaviors, ideas, attitudes, values, habits, beliefs, customs, language, rituals, ceremonies, and practices peculiar to a particular group of people, and provides them with a general design for living and patterns of interpreting reality. Now, that's really seriously heavy. I had to take a pause and a deep breath on that. Cultural values. A complex pattern of attitudes, beliefs, and ideas that give order and direction to human conduct. See, this is what I've been explaining and how we can turn things around. The seven virtues of Mayotte, which are standards of behavior, would be truth, the coherence, consistency, and correspondence. The truth and authenticity of self are very important to who we are to become. Justice, fairness, flexibility, protection, reciprocity, and the synonym for that is righteousness, integrity, right conduct, sharing, compassion, empathy, joy, patience, balance, stability, modesty, harmony, peace, beauty, grace, residence, order, formality, civility, dynamism, and virtuality. See, framing this for people, this is what I do in teaching this and using in my practice, is using this as a basis for people to get back to where they need to be as that universal being. And then using that power of the spirit and this concept of what we call veneration of the person. And veneration is the highest thing you can do for someone, to place them in a position of the greatest respect and admiration. To be a person is to be a living being possessing, knowing, and have a knowable spirit. A person is both a container and instrument of divine energy and relationship. The human being is a power, a phenomenon of perpetual veneration, which deserves high regard and deep respect. See, that's the definition of being a human being.
Mm-hmm.
Having that would not allow me to be disrespectful to a woman or to harm another human being unless it's in defense of myself or my family. Would not allow me to shoot down in cold blood another human being, have no remorse or regret. It gives me the humanist part of my being that's attached to that veneration and spirit. And that's what I mold and shape. That's what I teach teenagers and youngsters. That's what I present to people. And people do get scared when it's African-centered. That's not to be scared of. They're more comfortable with cultural-centered. It's not the origin of it as much as the value of it in shaping and molding human beings. It's for everybody,
yes.
Regardless of what you call yourself. We're in the same boat. It's leaking really badly, and it's going to sink, and we're all going to be lost. The affluent, the so-called poor, the middle class, the politicians, we're all going to go down in that boat. It's going to sink. And then what are we going to do when it goes down? Whatever affects every human being affects us. And as one preacher said once, and it's always very touching with me, I'm trying not to get emotional about it, but he says that when we lose someone, we lose a piece. We lose a piece of our soul and who we are.
Yes.
And that connection requires me to have love and compassion for all other people, regardless of my differences with them. The differences do not necessarily have to cause conflict. We choose conflict. But conflict does not necessarily have to occur because we're different. Differences can build walls or it can build bridges. We have the tools to do either one. So, and I ask patients, are you a wall builder or a bridge builder? You connecting to yourself and other people, or are you building barriers that separate you? Those are some fundamental questions I ask of youngsters and folk there.
Well, you have given us, Dr. Richardson, many, many ways in which everyone, not just mental health professionals, but us as a microcosm of the universe, is being interconnected to each and every one that we meet, see, greet, breathe. We are all interconnected, and you've given us ways to better have a discussion or a conversation about this. You're erasing much of the stigma that we have, and one of the several things that you have mentioned that we can do as a people is with mental health, emotional health, is to one, educate yourself. Number two, check on those around you. Check on those around you. Check on those around you. Number three, ask how you can help. We're all interconnected. You know, there was a time when we helped each other. If you needed a cup of sugar and my family had a cup of sugar, you could easily walk over and say, can I borrow a cup of sugar? The world, that's the world we need to go back to, where we took care of each other. We looked after each other and do it even better. Ask how you can help. Be careful when you choose your words. Stop calling people using mental health terms. Oh, they're schizophrenic. Oh, they act like they're bipolar. Oh, they act like they're crazy. Excuse me? Unless you took your test and got a license, please don't use that kind of verbiage, because it's so negative. It's just so negative. Choose your words carefully. Number 5, engage others in conversation about mental health. From whatever level you can come from, engage people. Talk about, have conversations about this. And Dr. Richardson, I look for us to have many more conversations about this matter. And 6, take care of your own MH. Take care of your own mental health so you can feel connected, not separated, so that you can remember that you were divinely created. Yes. I'm about to preach here, y'all. Watch out. Number 7, express empathy. Express empathy. I'm just going to move on from that. Just express empathy towards one another. Know that you are divinely created and that we all are interconnected. And if we all believe that we are interconnected, we couldn't hurt, harm, or speak ill of another, because we know that that other person is a part of us. This is Emotions Are Us with your host, Dr. Bev, and my guest, Dr. Larry Richardson. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I enjoy doing it.
And you won't be cut off. And guess what? I'm going to have you back on the show again.
Okay. If I'm not ostracized and taken out to be born and quartered.
No, we'll watch out. You know, that okay, we make we put your picture up there that, look, he is not wanted. You know, don't go after him. But, you know, maybe not, we might not put that picture up there, because you know what? They already had. Look, Dr. Richardson, this is the age of electronics. This is the age of Google. I've already said your name many times. Trust me, somebody going to G-O-O-G-L-E you, and they will find you. Okay, so you out there, you're open, and you've been very, very authentic. And thank you for giving your view of what this is all about. I think that is very special. And again, I appreciate you and thank you so much for being on the show. This is Emotions Are Us, America Out Loud. You heard it here first, folks. What? Be out loud, America. Come on, let's do it. Emotions are all of us.